Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, our topic is freshwater mussels, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Marcia May, an aquatic wildlife biologist. Marcia, welcome, and can you tell us more about yourself?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, I worked for Texas Parks and Wildlife for many, many years from 2001 until 2018. And during that time, I worked with a citizen science project called Texas Nature Trackers. And one of the programs from Texas Nature Trackers was Texas Mussel Watch. And it was just an amazing citizen science group. And it's still going on through a program called iNaturalist. We have a project, Texas Mussel Watch in iNaturalist, and where people can record their sightings. But a little bit about me, life has been one build after another. I started off in high school not knowing what the heck to do. Nobody helped me with any sort of direction. And when I got out of high school, I started taking community college classes. And from there, as I took courses, I learned more and more about what was out there and what was available. And with my interests, because I always loved catching frogs and being in the streams and being out in the woods and looking for tracks and all that kind of stuff. Even though I grew up in the Chicago area, we had a great forest preserves and I spent a lot of time in the forest preserves. And so from there, I started off as a vet tech. I went to school to be a veterinary technician. I did that for several years, again, taking more classes. And then from there, I started working at the community college as the head biology lab assistant. I did that for several years. Then I went back to school. I went to Texas A&M University, got a degree, a BS in wildlife from there, and then went straight on to Texas State University in San Marcos. And I received my master's in aquatic biology. And during that time, I did volunteer work for Texas Parks and Wildlife. I recommend if you ever want to work for an agency or work for anyone, volunteer, get to know people. That helps you, to get a job.
And also to know if you're even going to like the field. You get
hands-on like
experience.
The field. Yeah, do that before. I think you need to do that before you even go to college.
Absolutely.
That way, you're not spending 4 years in a university and get out and go, well, I kind of don't like this work.
Right.
Yeah, so then from there, I was able to get a job working for Texas Parks and Wildlife. And I worked as the coordinator for Texas Nature Trackers for many, many years. And it was very, very wonderful. We really worked hard on with citizen science and trying to have it so the data collected by citizen science is accepted by the scientific community. That was really the most important part. And I think through the program iNaturalist, which some of you may be familiar with iNaturalist, you can take photographs of subjects and put it on iNaturalist, and a professional can come and make sure that your identification is correct. And that data can then be used by agencies and such. With Parks and Wildlife, I know the data we collected, the herp data, like frogs and toads and snakes and things like that, that herp data was used to determine, what species were rare and so forth. So citizen science data is very important, very important.
And it's so wonderful because those are the people who really care and are out every day.
Yeah.
And the other agencies and the other companies and organizations don't have the staff in the field, on the ground. And with citizens out there, and I love iNaturalist too. I learn more from that, mostly being corrected on my IDs, which is wonderful. It's like a free source of experts.
Fun. Yeah, great source of experts. Yeah, so when I started in 2003, we were really just starting this program, Texas Mussel Watch. And since I have a master's in aquatic biology, I really sort of dug into it and learned everything I could about the subject and how to identify all the species. In Texas, we have around 52 species. I say around because some of those species are now being lumped and split, and a lot of research is being done in Texas with freshwater mussels, which is not the case in all states, which is very sad. But since we're doing a lot of research here, the number of species is going to vary, you know, from year to year, depending on what they find, because I know a lot of genetic work is being done. And we have around 52 species, which is not a lot. If you go further east in the United States, there are at least, I think the greatest number of species are in Alabama. They have the most species in Alabama, but the Tennessee River Valley has a lot of species too, and many more than what we have in Texas. And the Pacific Northwest doesn't have as many species. I did my research. The species that I found were the Western Pearl Shell, which is in the family Margaritifidae, and also the Western Ridged Mussel, which is in the family Unionidae. And between those two, they really like swift waters, constant swift waters. So they do really well in a lot of the flowing waters that you find. Not that it has to be a constant flowing water, not an intermittent, because the mussels have to be able to attach and hold on and not be pushed downstream constantly if you've got intermittent flows.
And the Umpqua watershed sounds perfect.
Perfect. And your smaller streams and creeks and lakes and reservoirs, there's the species. They lump them all together as floaters because it's still not known for sure how many species of floaters you actually have. Floaters tend to do well where there's deep substrates. They're light, very lightweight, and they can stay above the silt. And this is an example of a giant floater. Find the right people.
Wow, it's almost as big as a softball, baseball, something like that.
And this is not its huge, I mean, it can get twice as big.
Now, how come that's not a clam? I'm looking at it on the screen here. What's a different, what is a mussel? Let's define that for the very, very new to our program
I
or new
know
to the
that it's
topic.
always that's always a question. And mussels are usually more marine, and they have different structures than what we call mussels. But they're all bivalves. They're all in the same group of bivalves.
And then tell us what a bivalve is.
A bivalve is, this is the giant floater, and when you separate it two, it has two different halves. Each half is called a valve.
I
So
see. So each half of the shell.
this is a valve and this is a valve.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so we call this is a bivalve,
Gotcha.
two valves. So that's where you get it. All mussels, not mollusks, because mollusks are a really very interesting group of animals, because it also includes octopus, the octopi, and squid. They're all in the mollusk group, along with snails and, gastropods type things. So anyway, what we're talking about here are bivalves and a freshwater mussel bivalves, native freshwater mussel bivalves.
Okay, we know that all life came from the ocean, and so originally these animals were salt animals. What accommodations did they have to do for mussels to become freshwater? Is there any difference between the salt and the freshwater?
Well, it's really just the way that they handle the salt.
Okay, so internal processes.
They have evolved in a more freshwater environment. A saltwater mussel would have to figure out ways of making sure that its body doesn't get filled with salt. Because, totally different. It's like a saltwater fish and a freshwater fish. You can't put a freshwater fish in the ocean, depending on the species. There are some mollies that can do
Except for the ones that go back and forth, right? So mussels typically don't. There's never a mussel that can go in both.
And pretty much where they live is where they stay, but the only way of dispersal for these guys is through their life cycle. First, I'll have this other shell that's nice and big, and it has, you can see all the parts. And just let's learn a little bit about the parts. This mussel is called a bluefur, but it is found in Texas and further east. And this particular one is found in East Texas. But freshwater mussels, unfortunately, the easiest way to identify them is from the inside.
Okay, and for our listeners, she's holding up a bigger than a softball size shell.
This is
It's an elephant, yeah, almost elephant ear.
Anyway, this is the inside. And so they have different parts that we look at when we're identifying them. First, if you look at the shell, the outside of the shell is called the periostracum, or it's more like an epidermis. And that can wear off over a period of time. And then the inside of the shell is where it's real pearly. That's called the nacre, NACRE. And that nacre can be various colors. This one, it's kind of hard to tell, but it's got sort of a pinkish color.
Yeah,
And
I would think it
then,
was an oyster. Like I would look at that and think it has that shine and that pinkish kind of glow of an oyster shell.
well, oysters have nacres too.
Yeah, okay.
They have and the nacre is where you get the pearl from, because and you can get pearls from freshwater mussels too.
Oh,
If
okay.
you have like in a freshwater mussel, they have the nacre, and then when the animal is alive, on the inside there is a tissue that is called the mantle, and the mantle is what excretes the calcium that builds the shell. And you can tell by the outside how there's layers, and each layer is kind of like a tree ring. When they grow, they start growing from this area here called the beak.
Kind of the base, yeah, where they connect.
This is where the little baby would be this big, and then as they get older, they add to those layers, and the mantle is what's adding to the layers. So there has to be calcium in the water for a mussel to grow.
Okay. All righty.
Yeah, they have to have that calcium in the water for the mussel to grow. And so you're looking at the inside, and so here is an area that's the hinge. So like when the animal opens up, they will open up like they hinge together, and they
Great.
will open up like this.
Great.
Like, and they don't just open like that. You know, they have tissue that's kind of ligaments that are holding it together, and they may open just a little bit so that they have these. We used to call them siphons. They call them apertures now that have an in current and an excurrent aperture so they can take water and food in and release
Okay.
their feces out. So the inside, it starts with the nacre, and then we have those hinges. And there are two on this particular mussel, and many of them, there's two sets of teeth. Those long teeth right here are called the hinge teeth, right here, are the
Okay.
These are the lateral teeth. It goes right along the hinge there. And then down at the base, right here, is these little bumps. These are called the pseudocardinal teeth.
Okay.
Different muscle species have different shapes of those teeth. And
So
so
that's
that's,
one of the identifying factors
yeah,
for
that's
them,
an
I would assume.
identifying
Okay.
factor. But interestingly enough, all the floaters in the family Anodontidae have no teeth.
Okay, so that it is an identifying factor.
Yeah, so you find a mussel that's kind of thin-shelled and it has no teeth, then you can throw it into that
Okay,
genus.
good.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Anodonta. And so those six species of Anodontas and all have no teeth
All
in the
righty.
Pacific Northwest. Mussel scars, where the muscles of the body attach, and you have them here and here. When you actually crack open a muscle, you've actually killed it. I know.
Why? Why?
Because its
Or how?
whole body is inside. The body is inside and it's in a mantle. And when you open it up, you've teared it, torn it apart.
Wow.
So
Yeah, so don't do that.
that's what they do when you eat them. But
Right.
and the thing about eating these is another thing to note is that mussels are so important in the aquatic ecosystem because they filter feed. And I call them the vacuum cleaners of the river system. Their job is to filter the water, and they do a marvelous job of it. They'll take in nutrients and they'll excrete other nutrients. Most people think of, oh my gosh, they're just rocks. And
Right.
oftentimes in the substrate, all you're going to see is the very top of the mussel in the substrate. So half the time, people don't even know they're there.
Right.
So they're filtering, constantly filtering the water. And they're also, they get this biofilm on their shells. There's perfect habitat for those little macroinvertebrates, like the little, like dragonfly larvae.
Right.
All those little larvae can live on that habitat. Even the dead shells make great habitat for those little macroinvertebrates. And those are really good food for fish. So if you think about it, mussels are really good for fish because they are supplying habitat for fish food.
Right. They're an ecosystem for the fish.
Very important part of the aquatic ecosystem. Very, the foundation of the aquatic ecosystem are these guys.
So I can assume, what does it tell you when you find mussels in a river? Does that mean a pristine or a good river?
If you find native freshwater mussels in a river, that is a good indication that you have a healthy river.
And if you don't,
and if
the
you
opposite.
Well, it depends on the system, you know.
Okay.
If you're talking about, you know, a river that is fed by, in the Pacific Northwest, if you're finding rivers that are fed by snowmelt and you've got this fast flow and, you know, everything gets pushed downstream, you're not going to find mussels in those habitats. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it's poor quality.
Right. Okay.
It just means that the habitat is not conducive for freshwater mussels because they have to have enough infrastructure in order to, they have a what's called a foot, you know, this big foot that they use to anchor themselves into the substrate to hold on around the rocks and whatever. And they're pretty deep into the substrate, so that helps them from being pushed downstream too.
Okay.
But the presence is really, if they're there, then you know you've got really good quality because they're very sensitive to changes in pollutants.
Okay.
And that's another thing that I read. I used two publications when I prepared myself because I'm more familiar with Central Texas than I
Right.
am the Pacific Northwest. But I did find that the resources I used were native freshwater mussels in the Pacific Northwest by the Syrces Society. It's a guide. It's a great, it was written in 2015. Really good, good resource, really good resource. Another one was the freshwater mussels of the Pacific Northwest, and they didn't have a date, but it was through U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and it has a really nice key along with all the mussel species in it. So, and they're free online. So those are
awesome.
Yeah, those are really good resources. They did mention there are some invasive species.
Right.
I say invasive. It depends on the species. The one is the Asian clam.
Okay.
Corbicula, genus Corbicula. The Asian clam was brought to the U.S. through the Asian community, starting off in the Pacific, in the Western states. And it's now, they've now moved all over. They are hermaphroditic. So you have one, you have all a bunch.
Right.
And they are very, very tolerant of pollutants.
Oh,
So if you have... it's said in these publications that these were, they directly compete with our freshwater mussels. And I'm sure they do in certain situations, but if the habitat is such where the Asian clam can survive, but the native mussel can't, then you're going to find more abundance of Asian clams in that habitat.
Right.
So a lot of it too depends on the habitat. You know,
well, tell me what competition would be among mussels. If they're filter feeding, you know, that piece of filter food goes by you, it goes by. It's not like if you don't get it, someone else won't. So what is the competition? What are they competing for?
So they live in a bed.
You know,
they live in a group. They're living in a bed. They all usually live pretty close so that they can easily reproduce. You have all these freshwater mussels. If you have the native mussels mixed in with a whole bunch of Asian clams,
right.
Asian clams are going to get the food before the mussel does.
Okay, so they are indeed competing for food.
For food. Oh, yeah. The competition is food. But I do not believe that it's as bad as a situation where we have zebra mussels. And I don't believe you might have quagga mussels in Pacific Northwest, but they usually tend to be more in more lake environments, bigger water body environments.
Right.
So maybe in a reservoir or something like that. But I don't really know for sure how many zebra mussels you actually have there.
Well, isn't there one that we're very concerned about and they check the boats as they come across the state borders and whatnot? Is that the zebra?
That's the zebra mussel, yeah.
And tell me what the problem with that guy is.
Zebra mussels, they're little tiny things. Their babies are called veligers, and those little veligers swim around in the water. So if you take water from a water body that has zebra mussels, like in a boat, like a well of a boat, and you move that boat to another lake, lakes usually, if take it to another lake and release that water into that lake, you're releasing zebra mussels because those are the babies. And they will just attach to anything and start to grow. And when they grow, they grow exponentially because they don't have a normal predator in these
Oh,
environments here. They are originally from the Black Sea and that area in Asia, and they were brought over in the 1980s, right around the Great Lakes, and the ballast of ships from regions in Europe and Asia where they were already established. And they were released there, and they just grew and grew and grew and grew. We have them in Texas. I was here at Parks and Wildlife when we first observed them in Texas. It was in North Texas and Lake Texoma. They found one adult in Lake Texoma. It was somewhere around 2006, 2007, 2008, somewhere around there. Within a very short period of time, they started seeing them in other lakes. We don't have any natural lakes, we just have reservoirs. If you look at Texas, it just has all these rivers draining to the Gulf Coast, all these rivers, and they've built reservoirs on those rivers. So those are the lakes that these things are going into. And they're more of a lake species than they are rivers. And they just attach to everything and anything. And they are a problem with the freshwater mussels because when they attach to the mussels, they attach to the hard surface of the mussel and they are competing for food. They also make it difficult for the mussel to open, to feed, and
Okay, so they submerge everything or cover everything.
they cover everything, even intake valves and things like that. So water treatment facilities are having a heck of a time keeping up with them, and oh, they're a mess. Yeah.
So any
So
kind of water filtering services they do are nullified by their
yeah.
omnipresence.
Oh yeah. There's no predators, you know. So there are some birds that might eat them, but they're not like the predators that were in the original water body where they came from.
And then you'd mentioned another invasive mussel. You said the Asian clam or something. Now you said clam. Is it a clam or is it a mussel?
Well, it is a freshwater mussel, but it's been called an Asian clam.
Okay, so
So
the common name is clam. So clams are different than mussels. Okay.
yeah, to a certain degree. I mean, if you look at the internal structures of the Asian clam compared to the native mussels, they're a totally different structure. They have two different, their lateral teeth are on both sides. So they're just totally different structure, totally different life cycle. Like I said, they're hermaphroditic. They have
And
both sex characteristics inside, and they can fertilize themselves and
so
make them.
mussels do not.
No,
M
no.
mussels are either female or male.
Yeah, they're female or male. Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
All
there's
right.
a couple species that might be hermaphroditic, but most of them are female and male. And the ones that I'm most familiar with are in the family Unionidae. And you have one that's not, yeah, one that's not in that family. But I did read that they both reproduce the exact same way. So it's going to apply to both. These mussels do, which is fascinating. I told you about the apertures and so they're going to be like these two that stick up like that, in current, ex current. So males, they all live in a mussel bed together. The males will release sperm in the water. And the females will inhale the sperm. And that sperm goes into a brood pouch that's located right around the gills. They have gills like fish, and in the gills. And that brood pouch is where the eggs are. They mix the eggs and the sperm, they get fertilized. And then those babies develop. And they develop into little tiny mussels that are, like this. They're called Glaucidia, Glaucidia, Glaucidia. And those little Glaucidia, all of our native mussels have the most fascinating ways of attracting a fish host. Their life cycle includes a parasitism on a host.
Oh, tell
And
me. Okay.
it's usually a fish. I've heard there's some species that might be frogs, but in most cases in Unionidae, it's a fish. Can be some species are more generalist, so it can be any fish, Some species are specific, so it has to have a specific fish in that system to reproduce. And those are usually the ones that are muscles that are rare because they're dependent on a rare fish. So if
Got
you
it.
don't have both in the system, you're not going to get, you're not going to get recruitment or babies
Right.
out of the deal. So okay, the female is impregnated, the babies are called Gluckidia, and they have various mechanisms of attracting that host fish.
Okay.
Some of them just, when they open, they have a little like a worm-like thing on the inside, and the fish will come along and it'll snap its head in and release the Gluckidia, because the Gluckidia goes through the fish mouth and through the to the gills. If you go into the fish's mouth, the gills are right there.
So does the
And
fish eat these guys, or they just jump on the fish when it comes close?
it jumps on the fish when they come
Okay,
close.
gotcha. All righty.
Unless the muscle can actually grab it. And in the Eastern, I've gone to mussel workshops, and I've seen pictures of these mussels in Eastern, like a fan shell or something that actually does attach to the fish and, hold on to it. And the specific fish that it needs has a really tough head, so it can handle being smashed by
Yeah.
a mussel. So,
All righty.
yeah, really interesting. But that's one way. Another way is some species, like in the Lampsilis genus, they have these lures that they will open up, and they'll have this lure, and it looks like a fish, and it looks like maybe a little darter or some kind of predator or prey fish,
Right.
and a big predator fish will come along, like a bass or something, and it'll see that because the muscle's moving it, like
Right.
and
Like a
it'll
little
come,
lure. Yeah.
and it'll grab it. And when it grabs, as soon as it gets really close to the muscle, even, it will release those Gluckidia. So there's a good chance it'll get the fish will take it in.
Okay, here was I was confused. So the mom is attracting the fish. Okay, I thought the babies were attracting their host fish.
No.
And I was
It's
thinking the babies must be too small.
no,
Okay,
they're
I
great.
got it. The
Yeah, it's
mom attracts
the
the
mom
fish.
has the lure in the shell.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they have it in the shell, and she was the one who produces this. It's called a mantle lure.
Oh,
It
cool.
it's comes from the inside the mantle part of the shell, and there's a mantle lure, and that's some species. Others have other female mussel species
Yeah.
have these long conglutinous masses that are red, and they look like worms, and the fish will come along and eat it. And get the Gluckidia in their gills that way. So they have all these amazing adaptations to attract the fish that is specific to their life cycle.
Okay, so the mom calls the fish over with one of her lures or one of her tricks, and then she sends off her babies into the fish's mouth, basically, or into their gills. And then the babies find a spot to hang out on the gills or
Yeah,
on
they
the side.
attach to the gills. They
Okay.
are considered parasitic,
Okay.
but it's they're very, very, very tiny, and they don't normally kill the host. I
Okay.
mean, not a good idea to kill your host, put
No, that'd wipe you out in the
it.
end. Right.
Yeah. So they'll attach to those gills. They develop internally, but not externally. So they're not going to get any bigger in
Right.
those fish gills. They stay that tiny size, but inside they're developing. And then, as soon as sometimes it may be a week, a month, depending on the species, they'll fall off and
Okay.
they'll dig themselves into the substrate, and they stay there for a while until they get big enough to come to the surface.
Okay,
So,
so would this fish be a local fish who probably hangs out in the same area? Or would this be a fish that would go down the stream a couple miles? Not necessarily.
well, it depends. I've heard
Okay.
that in your area, that you have trout and the salmonids, the trout,
Right.
the salmon, I guess. But when they come in, they're in that habitat for, a month or so before they
Right.
actually, while they're breeding, and then they die.
Right.
So that time period is when the mussels can attach to the salmon, and the salmon will drop. So imagine you could find, I'm just imagining this, but
Yeah.
imagine you could find mussel populations in those habitats where the
Which
salmon
is a
come in.
beautiful way to disperse.
Yeah.
and reach
Oh, yeah.
farther out habitats. So that makes a lot of sense.
It's
Oh,
very
that's,
important for dispersal.
oh
Yeah.
my gosh, I never thought about we talk a lot about why we want to keep our salmon, and we talk about a
Yes,
lot of the
yeah.
benefits, and I never knew about that benefit. They're helping the mussels kind of
Yeah.
disperse.
Yeah,
And the
well,
stronger the salmon, maybe the farther up a stream it can reach if it doesn't run into the dams, but the farther up it can go. And
the dams can be a problem. Yeah.
wow, this is very cool. I love this. Okay.
Yeah, dams are a problem for
For everything. Yeah.
mussels too. Yeah.
Okay.
They're just such fascinating creatures. Totally fascinating creatures. And I know when I first started working at Texas Parks and Wildlife, very little was known about our species here. And most agencies were like, who cares? I hate to say that about agencies, but
Right.
it wasn't really a species that people cared about.
Right.
And over a period of time in Texas, we got to get to where those species were listed as state threatened because they were. And previous to that designation, I don't know if you have that, and I imagine you have that in Oregon, a state threatened or endangered listing for species in
Oh,
Oregon.
sure. Oh, sure. Yeah.
So if because I did notice that very little protection, there's very little protection in the Pacific Northwest of these mussel species. And freshwater mussels throughout the whole United States are highly endangered or at-risk organisms. One of the statistics I found quite fascinating was that nearly three quarters of all the 297 native freshwater mussel species in North America are imperiled, and nearly 35 went extinct in the last century.
Wow.
So they are very, very rare. And so, and it's a crisis in the United States. 40 so at risk species, 40% of populations are at risk in the United States. And the freshwater habitat of these species are impaired. 55% of the habitat in the United States is impaired. And the projected extinction rate in the next 10 years is 70% extinction.
Wow.
Yeah. So these. It's really important, I think, for people to know about these organisms and how important they are in the aquatic ecosystem. And I think if you get people out there looking and finding them, they'll have a totally new opinion of these, just these little rocks that are in the ground. I remember I did a workshop in up near Waco one time, and teaching people how to identify find freshwater mussels in the
Yeah.
river up there. And there was a woman that I never would have expected to really be excited about mussels. She had, the perfect hair and the makeup and the dress, and she was very, very, petite. But boy, when she got out in the middle of the river, she was like, "This is so much fun." It was just so wonderful to, you open people's eyes. It'd be great. I don't know, if anyone's working on it, but it would be great for people to maybe start groups, maybe even the Umpqua watershed, start a citizen science group. And you can start off by just walking the shoreline. You don't have to go in the water. You can go the short walk the shoreline and just look for shells, take
Okay.
pictures of shells. They're protected, so it's you can't keep the shells. You have to have
Okay.
permit to do that. But you could walk along, take pictures of the inside, the outside of a shell that you find on the shoreline, and then use iNaturalist to help identify them.
Okay.
And then,
Now, why are those shells there? Who are the predators of these
there's lots,
critters?
many predators. I mean, that's another part of the importance of them in the
Right.
water body. Is that they're also a good food source for many animals. Well, there are some fish that will eat them. There are herons and birds will eat them. Raccoons will eat them. Any of those animals, and usually they'll drag them up on the shoreline and eat them. Or if the water level has gone down some, you can find shells too. It's interesting. Some mussel species can move. If the water level goes down, some mussel species can use that foot to kind of get them back into the water, but some don't and die on the shoreline. So that just walking the shoreline, you can find mussel shells.
But if you do find one in the water, first of all, they will be stuck to something, right? You will have to probably pry them off.
No, they're pretty easy to pick up.
Okay.
They'll pretty easy to pick up. But you really have to be very gentle with them and put them right back.
And don't open them because, as you said earlier, that kills them.
Yeah,
You can't
don't
open it and look
open
at them and then put them back. You've
Don't
done the
open.
job on them.
Don't open them. Sometimes, I would. Well, a great way of learning how to survey mussels is there's just various ways of doing it. It depends. It's always depends on what the question is.
Right.
Question is, what mussel species are in this water body? What mussels are possibly, what mussel species are recruiting, having babies in the water body? You first have to come up with the question that you want to answer. But one of the great books here is The Guide to Sampling Freshwater Mussel Populations by
Okay.
David Strayer and David Smith. That is a really good guide for determining how to do mussel surveys. And also, I read that the Xerces Society, you can contact them too, and they will help you to lay out a plan of doing surveys in a
Okay.
water body. So they are also a really good resource for your area.
Okay.
So, and that one guide, the Freshwater Mussels of the Pacific Northwest, has a really good field guide in there where it even has a key to
Okay.
identifying the mussels up there. It's a lot easier in your region than it is in Texas because you have a
Right.
lot less species.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. So your options are limited. Tell me, can mussels see? Like, for instance, these moms looking for a fish, can they see the fish, or do mussels know where they are?
That's kind of a anthropomorphic question because
Yeah.
people know we know where we are, but I think no, they don't have eyes. And the inside of their bodies within that mantle, they do have a nervous system because they'll close up if you pick them up, and
Right.
they have a nervous system. They have heart, or a rudimentary type of heart. They have a stomach and gills, and they have all the organs inside that shell. Similar to what we have, they do not have eyes, but they do have nerves. So they are going to respond to being picked up. Usually, when they're picked up, they immediately shut.
Right.
And the very first thing they'll do is to shoot water out of
That
the experience, the sight.
why? Why would they do that? Oh, okay.
It's just what they do whenever you pick them up, they just shoot
Okay.
water out. So that was always my way of knowing that the animal was alive because I pick it up and go.
They
Water
squirt.
was squirting out of
Right.
it.
Now, you did say they have gills. So
Yes.
if you pick them up out of the water, they're going to be suffocated if you hold them out for very long, right?
Right. You can't keep them out for very long. No, they're not. And
Right.
it's not like a fish where they're going to die right away, but you would want to because they do clam up.
Yeah, so
But you don't want to keep them outside. I would only recommend picking them up if you're doing that for a specific reason, for a
right.
specific study. I don't recommend picking up live mussels otherwise, because they've found their niche, they found their habitat.
Right.
So the bet you're better off looking for shells.
You know, earlier when I asked, do they know where they are? Would they know, and how would they feel like being about being translocated or relocated? Could you pick them up and put them in a bucket and take them to a different stream and relocate them? Would
That
they?
would be, see, there's so many factors involved, and
Okay, tell
usually
me.
a professional is the best person, best group to do that, a professional group. Because we've had people do that here in Texas in areas where when we were in drought and water bodies became nil, there were no water,
Right.
and they would relocate these mussels, but you have to make sure you. It should be done by professionals, number
Right.
one. And they need to know what they're doing.
Right.
Because some of the factors involved, you need to have the right fish in the new habitat. You need to have
Oh,
the
exactly.
flow in the new habitat. You need to have the right nutrients in a new habitat. So there are so many factors involved in that new habitat that I think the professionals should be doing that.
You're right, I hadn't thought about that. They're not just sitting there reproducing. For instance, let's say the slug, which is one of their Relatives.
Relatively. Yeah.
You could maybe pick up, I'm not telling anyone to do this, but let's say you could pick up a banana slug from one forest and take it to another forest. And it would, if the forest was somewhat similar, it would probably be somewhat okay. Not ecologically okay for the environment because you don't know what you're
Yeah,
transferring,
you
but the
don't.
animal has a better chance of survival than a mussel who might be very specifically dependent on its particular spot.
Yeah, and maybe the banana slug. I don't, it depends on what it's eating.
Right. And I don't know anything
One
about
forest
them,
from the next could be quite different. So, yeah, I don't know enough about that either. But
but
yeah, it's not a good idea to move animals anyway.
no, it's not. I was just thinking in case of, for instance, a stream drying up or
Yeah.
something like that. Yeah.
In that case, contact U.S. Fish and Wildlife and
Right.
see what they can possibly do to help with that.
Oh,
I
interesting. Okay, my mind is thinking now. Oh.
know they're fascinating animals. They just really, really are. And some of them are absolutely beautiful. Oh, they can live anywhere from 10 years to over 100,
Oh, I was going to
depending
ask
on the
that.
species. And I
Yeah.
read that the Western pearl shell that's found in swift waters up there, they can live to be over 100 years old, which is amazing. And but the thinner shelled ones, like the floaters, maybe 10 or 15 years. They don't live quite,
Okay.
but some of those in Western pearl shell and the ridge mussel, Western ridge mussel, they can live over 100 years.
Right.
Oh, well, that's quite fast. Yeah, that's really fascinating for that a small animal like that. And
Yeah.
in Texas, we have this thing called a washboard that is, as big as a plate, and they can live over 100 years, a washboard.
Now
They're
those giant ones, like those and the one you showed me earlier, were those used for a food source for Native Americans or historically how were they looked at by the native peoples or even the early Europeans?
Well, my understanding is the Europeans didn't really like the taste of them, so they
Okay.
didn't. But that's my understanding. But
Yeah.
they do find freshwater mussel shells in middens from areas where native people had lived, like along
Okay.
riverbanks. They find them in those middens, and so they did. They used them for many things, tools. They ate them, for many things.
And
Yeah.
I know out east they were even a type of currency, the shells.
Oh,
I forget
yeah.
what they were called back there, wampum or
Much.
something, but they
Yeah,
were
yeah.
used as currency, especially the dark blue and purple ones.
Oh, yeah. And then if you, and they were used for many years for buttons.
Oh, okay.
They
All
used
right.
them for buttons, and spent a lot of mussels were taken out of the Mississippi River for the button industry.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I know calcium is a very important mineral for many animals. Do any animals eat the shells or depend on the shells or chew on the shells for calcium intake? Any other large mammals or, I don't know, raccoons or any other?
I don't know of any. I really
Okay,
don't. Yeah.
I'd be
I mean,
curious.
it's possible, but I don't know.
Have you seen any type of mussel that has a unique adaptation to its environment, unusual from other ones? Neat stories of different evolutionary tracks.
Well, I think the lures are what's unique,
Yeah.
because they evolved with fish and evolved with those host fish. So, especially the Lampsilus ones that have the lures that look like fish. Yeah,
Right.
I think that's just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's
Yeah,
very cool.
I went to a mussel conference once, and we're all people who go to mussel conference are a little on the geeky side, of course. So we were sitting there watching this video of this mussel, and again, this was the fan shell that I mentioned earlier, and it had opened, had that little lure on the inside of the shell, and the fish came along, and it put its head in the shell, and the shell closed up, and the lochidia was released, and the whole audience just clapped.
Oh, neat. And it doesn't hurt the fish generally.
General, no, because if your host dies, the baby dies too, so
Right.
it's not a good idea to kill your host.
Right. Well, once they leave that larval stage or the baby stage or whatever we call it, well, first of all, when they are those larvas, do they have any kind of shell on them whatsoever when they go into the fish?
They have a little tiny, tiny shell. They look
Tiny,
like
tiny shell, okay.
little itty bitty clams. I've seen them in a microscope, and they're just little tiny clams, and they're doing this the whole time, so they're like, oh, whatever we can attach to.
Okay, so they're just reaching out to try to find something.
And that not all of them make it to the gills, only the lucky ones make it to the gills, and the others go off into the stream and die. So
So they will die if they don't get onto the gills. And why do they want to be on the gills?
because they actually feed on the bloodstream of in the gills.
Oh, so it is actually parasitic on the blood, kind of like our lampreys that we
They
love
don't
out here.
kill those, but they're parasitic on those gills, and when when the time comes, they fall off and the fish doesn't die. I
Okay,
think,
cool.
very rarely have I ever heard of a fish dying, and it was maybe a small fish that had too many Glaucidia. But it's still not a good idea to kill your host. I used to tell people in workshops, I'd be like, well, it's kind of like, you have a dinner party and you invite your friends over and you don't want to kill them all so that, with the food you feed them,
Right.
you're the host, you feed your friends, they leave, and then they can come back and eat again.
Right.
So you don't want
So once these babies, and then they relocate kind of, or maybe they don't, maybe they stay in the same area because that fish stayed in the same area.
Yeah, it depends on the fish, yeah.
Once they're adult or older, do they have any way to navigate after that point, after they drop off onto the ground and
Yeah, no. No, unless, I mean, like I said, with that foot, if they're outside of the water, they can move themselves into we're using that foot to kind of push themselves into the water. But no, they usually stay in the same place and they develop they Mostly the babies are underneath the surface of the substrate on the bottom of the river. They don't start coming to the top until they're old enough. So
okay.
you won't find those little babies on the surface of the riverbed. They're going to be underneath the surface of the riverbed
Okay.
until they develop and are big enough to handle the stream. This protects them when they're down below the riverbed. In that substrate, they're protected from flow because they're so tiny. If they were up on the top, they'd go floating downstream. So they're so tiny, they stay below, and that kind of protects them until they come up to the surface.
Okay. All right. Are there any other kind of like examples of social behavior muscles show to each other? Do
Well,
they communicate in any way? Do they send off any pheromones? Like, who knows when it's time to breed, for instance? Or is that just a seasonal thing based not on them, but on perhaps the temperature or
yeah,
the.
I'm not sure what actually gets them, to release sperm and eggs. Many of them are seasonal. Many of and they have certain seasons when they reproduce. I don't know the details of that, but I know that many are seasonal. And they say not to mess. If you're going to work with live animals, you need to know when those seasons are. Because if you pick up a female that's gravid, has Glaucidia, she may release her Glaucidia because you picked her up.
Right, and then they'd
So
be gone.
then those babies die. So it's a good idea to know when their season is if you're going to actually be doing surveys for live animals. It's good to know when the seasons are and not to survey during those seasons.
I
But
wonder, do you suppose they have any way to warn each other if a predator's in the area? Do you suppose they, if another guy shuts, if your neighbor shuts, do you know to shut? You shut your cell. Do you know if they communicate any way like that?
I do not
I
know
was
of
just
anyone.
curious. That would be.
Yeah, I mean, it's they live in really close quarters, so that imagine that any sort of movement is going to cause them to shut. So if the one shuts next to them, there's going to be a little bit of water flow, then
It'd
there's
be
going to be that type of communication, but I really don't know otherwise.
vibrations. Yeah, it's curious.
Yeah. They're fascinating.
Oh, I think they're wonderful. So what would happen if we had no muscles? Let's talk about just the big picture. What
Well,
would
for
we
one
lose?
thing, there would be a lot more invasive species. Zebra mussels, all the invasives would take over. Of course, if their muscles too. So if we had no muscles, we'd have none of those either.
Right.
So it would affect the quality of the streams and the river and the water bodies, because they are such an important a factor of that water body. They are the basis of the aquatic ecosystem. And so without them, there'd be less filtering going on, less nutrient movement, and less habitat for those macroinvertebrates. And because the macroinvertebrates also get food from the waste that's given off from the mussels when they release their
Right.
waste packets. And just, it'd just be a major loss in that part of the aquatic food cycle,
Right.
that important. They're almost like a keystone species. I've
Right.
never heard anyone say that, but they're almost like a keystone species because they are such an important part of that habitat.
And especially when they disappear, that's told you so much. You
Degradation
know,
in that water body.
we talk a lot about the spotted owl
Yeah.
in this environment, especially in this in this watershed. And people are like, well, we got other owls, why does it matter? And the point is not so much the importance of that specific owl, but what it says as a message. When you lose that owl, you've lost a huge ecosystem that that owl needed to survive. And now you don't
Yes.
know what you've lost. So it's the big
That's
picture.
right. That's
Losing
right.
that little owl is not so, it's not so much that little owl, it's what it's saying as the big picture. You've
Right.
lost
There,
an incredible ecosystem and you have no idea what you've lost at that point.
because many other species are dependent upon that same ecosystem.
Right.
It's like a friend of mine who works for a friend of mine who works in Texas. He was like, "Oh my gosh, we have many five species of mussels that are now being discussed to be federally listed as endangered." And that's right, all in Central Texas. And my friend was like, "Oh my gosh, if that happens, it's going to be crazy around here." I said, "But you do realize that those mussels are so important, important indicators of the habitat in that region, that if you protect those mussel species, you are also protecting that habitat for all these other species."
Right.
It's not like, "Oh no, an endangered species, all this work we're going to have to do." No, it means that that habitat will be protected into the future with those endangered species. And hopefully in the future they won't be endangered anymore, because that's how the whole process works. Look at the bald eagle. The bald eagle was an endangered species, and now it's been taken off the endangered species list because it's doing very well.
Right. Because its
And
habitat is doing well.
its habitat's doing well. And that to me is a great indicator of how the Endangered Species Act works.
Right.
Yeah, and it is important.
And again, it's not just to have the variety of lovely wildlife to observe. You know, there if we want to look at it from a selfish perspective, you know, there's still so many medicines and drugs and
Oh, so
whatnot that
many.
we get from plants and animals and trees and whatnot that we don't know about, but they're life-saving for humans. And
I mean,
wiping out these things before we know what we're talking about is a real disservice to
yeah, they
humanity
say
as
that
well.
freshwater mussels, many species never get cancer. And why? Why do they not get cancer? Well, that's a good question. That could be something that would help us. And I think that the diversity is so important because everything is connected.
Right.
Everything is connected. The spotted owl is connected to the trees that it lives in, is connected to the little organisms that live in the tree that's connected. It's everything is connected, and we are connected. So when we lose other species, that brings us closer to the loss of us.
Right.
In the long run, yeah. And who
And
wants
we,
I don't want to live in a world that's all cockroaches and, starlings and sparrows.
yeah, and we have a real hard problem looking at the long run. We
Yeah.
have another issue out here where some farmlands have been flooded to give more habitat for ducks, and
Yeah.
people are complaining, some people are complaining that, well, that's just bringing more mosquitoes. Well, you know, if you hadn't messed up with the land in the first place, the wetlands would have brought in more bats and more animals to eat the mosquitoes. You know, we
Yeah.
can't selectively handpick
And
what habitat we want.
With mosquitoes, I mean, mosquitoes, their little larvae live in the water. If you have the organisms in the water that eat the larvae, that's going to keep the population of the mosquitoes down because it's all a
It's
cycle.
all a connection. Yeah.
It's all connected. And anytime you mess with an ecosystem and you get an imbalance, then that's what happens.
Right.
It's just telling us that that ecosystem is not balanced.
Right.
Yeah.
Marcia, this has been so much fun. I had no idea. I usually think I know some stuff about the ecosystem and whatnot. I had no idea about mussels. In fact,
Yeah.
I was one of those folks who just thought mussels were an ocean animal. Like I really didn't realize they were in. I'm originally from Montana. I'm not sure if we have them or not. I'll have to go research,
Think
but
so.
I
I
was
think
never
so.
aware of mussels.
Yeah, well, most
Yeah.
people aren't, and that's what happened when I first started doing muscle watches. Most people are not aware of them at all.
Right.
Yeah,
Right.
hopefully, a lot of people, when they would walk out of my muscle workshops, they would love muscles when they
Right.
walked. That was my goal. Love
Right.
muscles.
Mine too. Let me remind our listeners. This has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Marcia May about freshwater mussels. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you could find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org, and thank you for listening.